Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. 3 years ago, at this time of the year, the world was living its last carefree days before a pandemic unprecedented in modern times would paralyze the global economy and put much of the global population under quarantine. And while COVID-19 no longer commands the same fear and fury it used to, is it still capable of causing widespread damage? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Wu Zhiwei, Director of the Center for Public Health Research at Nanjing University Medical School in China. Dr. Wu, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Now, around 3 years ago, COVID-19 was already infecting its first patients in China, giving the country's authorities enough reason to notify the World Health Organization of a potential global outbreak. When you look at the events of those initial weeks and months in hindsight, do you think the response to this threat was adequate given what was known and what was not known at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. Because back to almost 3 years ago, it was, you know, completely chaotic because we didn't know what the virus was and how it was transmitted, what kind of a consequence it would cause in the infected individuals. So I think that that time, particularly in the initial couple of months, we were completely in the blank. So of course, you know, in that kind of particular circumstances, the only thing is they're trying to complete block the virus transmission, and that's the best we could do. I think if you look back 3 years ago, it was a correct decision to do so.
Now, if something similar were to appear again, would you recommend the same course of action, or would you have something modified?
Well, I think, you know, first, it's unlikely the same scenario will happen again with coronavirus because now we know a lot more about this virus, how it mutates, how it transmits, and what kind of, you know, the medical problem it would cause. So the situation is completely different. But that said, I think, you know, we have much more experience in dealing with it. We know how to control it, contain it to a limited number of people getting infected, how to mobilize the medical services and the resources to deal with it. And the other thing is that we know we have vaccines that changes the landscape quite differently. So I think if now it happens again, we're probably much better prepared to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, 3 years ago, in those first chaotic weeks and months, the countries essentially emulated one another, everybody going for the strictest possible lockdown, even when they didn't have enough resources to sustain it. And I think over time, national strategies have become more self-sustaining and self-driven. When you analyze national responses at this point of time, can you single out any countries that you particularly like the way that they responded, and, you know, some nations that perhaps could be justifiably criticized for the actions that they took or didn't take?
Well, you know, it's very hard to judge other countries because their public health intervention, the response to the emergency public health issues are very much influenced or determined by the country's own medical capacity. There is no uniform the way of dealing with the public health or a viral outbreak like the COVID-19. But when I look back to the response various different countries took against this virus, I think, you know, in the complete blank period, people did not know anything about the virus. The best way is restrict people's movement, because we know that the movement is one of the key issue which helps the virus to transmit from one individual to another individual. So that's why initially we mobilize the resources. We actually put on restrictions on the social gathering and the mobility. And you can see that it was quite effective in dealing with the initial outbreak before we know anything about the virus. Mm-hmm. So I think this is very critical. Instead of just doing it as usual, and you just go around, we are not going to do anything, give you sufficient freedoms, and people get contracted. At that time, we don't have vaccines, we don't have medicines, then that people's life will risk.
Now, it's definitely the way, the approach that China took, and we have to admit it's now one of the richest countries per capita, and it has the resources to afford this kind of policy. Would you recommend the same approach to some of the poorest countries where people have to stay under the lockdown without, you know, having any means to survival, not just to, you know, healing or medical treatment, but bare survival? I'm talking about food, energy, etc.
Yeah, you raise a very good question. I don't think the Chinese model is can be applied to other countries, particular countries which are economically less developed and they have limited resources, because China's model requires a number of very important factors. First, it has to be a very strong government. A strong centralized government, it could could mobilize resources. And basically, when epidemic or a pandemic happened, or the outbreak happened in a particular region, very serious, overwhelm its healthcare system, then the government could mobilize the resources from a different jurisdictions to give support. So this requires a tremendous amount of central government authority, coordination, and cooperation. Mm-hmm. So first thing, you know, from this point of view, I mean, this model is hardly easily applied to other countries. It's very, very difficult. The mm-hmm. second is that during the past decade of economic development, China developed a very, very closed social network, which actually involves also, you know, commercial activities such as food deliveries and your you know, life support system, whatever, you know, you could simply purchase your living stuff from the internet and deliver to your doorstep. So those are things that actually give us sufficient support and the infrastructure logistics support to the lockdown approach. Without those, you can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, throughout this pandemic, we often heard from various experts that it's better to be safe than sorry, although this mantra, I think, didn't fully account for, you know, all the damage and the death toll that indirectly occurred. For example, you know, people suffering from the chronic diseases whose treatment was put on hold because all the attention was centered on the corona patients. I wonder if this pandemic changed a way the medical community approaches the treatment of chronic versus infectious diseases. Are these two fields still separated as they used to be?
Well, I think in the way it did change the way how, you know, physicians, healthcare workers to deal with chronic diseases and the acute infection like COVID-19. And in the other way, actually, you can see certain impact on the chronic diseases, as you just mentioned, because hospitals and the healthcare facilities have to prioritize their work in controlling the virus, in dealing with the severely infected individuals. So you can see that because in part of China, that when the outbreak happens, when a lot of patients flocked into hospitals, then some of the hospitals have to deal with the patients and the lockdown, and you have to go through all sorts of, you know, check and the medical examination before you are allowed to go in. So that in inevitably that affects the patient with clinical diseases. So there is a very complex issue here. I think this is something actually we learned in the past 3 years, that we have to develop a more effective and efficient way of dealing with this kind of a situation.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, that's called, in medical community, that's called the problem of triaging, that the doctors always have to, well, they would aspire to treat everybody, but they have to make very hard choices about who has better chances of survival. And, you know, that raises a lot of very, very, very hard ethical questions about the elderly, about the children, about the economy, et cetera. Have 3 years on, have we started going through that with some sort of honest analysis, or is it still something that humanity has to come to terms with?
You see, that's an interesting question. The triage idea is very much, you know, practiced in Western countries, particularly in European countries. Basically, you can see the similar model was practiced in Britain during the pandemic. But in China, actually, the triage was not or is not widely accepted in the medical community. What you see is that during the pandemic, some of the hospitals, in the peak of the Chinese pandemic, some of hospitals were just overwhelmed by COVID-19 patients. So that's one of the reasons why the government actually put a tremendous resources to build up those makeshift hospitals. Mm-hmm. So that for the patients who are not severely infected, they were transferred to those makeshift hospitals to get a certain medical treatment, so relieve the traditional hospital medical care facilities for patients who are actually either have other emergency conditions or chronic diseases. So I think this is a very good model in a way that because the infectious disease will not happen everywhere or every day, it sometimes happens when you have some emergency makeshift hospital facility to take them in. That would be a tremendous help.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, here in Russia, the traditional Chinese medicine is associated with what we call holistic approach. And I think this is one manifestation of such holistic approach, that you try to treat every member of your society, regardless of the age or survivability chances. Now, another thing I wanted to ask you is that it's clear that a patient's prognosis with COVID depended a great deal on his or her health status and his or her health condition. Again, chronic diseases and the preceding lifestyle, what have you. Do you think there are any lessons for all of us to be learned about how to sort of live our lives fully and healthily in order not to be so susceptible to epidemics or pandemics like this one?
Well, that's actually, it's a very good question, because if you look at from the Chinese perspective, okay, when COVID-19 outbreak and happens in various different Chinese cities, when the government called for self-restraint, okay, do not, make a big gathering and do not go to the avoid going to public places if it's, avoidable. Or wear your face mask and have some good health self-care, good habits. So basically, you can see that from the individual level, many people actually do it pretty well. You see that people have so-called self-reliance, and they take the health into their own hands. I think that's very critical for any society. When a pandemic happened, when there is a shortage of medicine or shortage of way of a therapeutic approach, then yourself is your first responsibility for your own health. So this is something very critical. The second is that I think it's very critical that for keeping good health, basically the first thing is avoid being infected. There are a number of ways of doing it. One is that take vaccines. The vaccines are safe, and particularly when you have some basic medical conditions, when you are in old age, particularly elderly people, over 70, 80, and we know that from clinical feedback that those people are highly susceptible to the virus, and they tend to develop some more severe complications. So this is very critical. That's why, in this particular age group and people with some basic medical conditions, they need to take vaccines, mm-hmm. because the vaccine's adverse effect is basically minimal when you compare with the vaccine's efficacies. Mm-hmm. So this is the two lessons we learned. One is self, restraint. Take your health into your own hands. The second is that rely on the available medical approach mm-hmm. to protect yourself.
I see. Well, Dr. Wu, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Wu Jiwei, Director of the Center for Public Health Research at Nanjing University Medical School in China. Dr. Wu, before the break, you said that there are a lot of things that we now understand about the COVID-19, but there are also plenty of things that we don't know. What would you say are still some of the biggest mysteries that puzzle you when you wake up at night about this particular virus?
Well, you know, first thing is that as a scientist, okay, it's very interesting that the previous coronavirus we knew, they don't just continuously infecting the population and going through individual to individual. And when the weather warms up, usually the virus goes away. When it cools down, the virus comes back. So basically it causes flu-like symptoms. But this virus, the SARS-CoV-2, is quite different. That's why initially in year 2020, many of us made a mistake. We thought that the virus would go away when the weather warms up, but it didn't. So apparently this is a highly persistent virus. It keeps going from human to human and mutating as well. It's interesting that the virus evolution, if you look at the early days in the year 2000, virus to the today's virus, they are very different. The virus adapts to the human population, becoming highly transmissible and infectious. But its pathogenesis is significantly compromised. It no longer causes severe diseases. All the virus actually, once getting into your body, it goes right into your lung and causes inflammation. So that actually often is quite fatal. But the new virus, the Omicron, since early this year, when it's starting circulating, spreading around, what we found is that the virus mostly just infects your upper respiratory tract. It doesn't go into your lungs. So that's why the symptom is relatively minor and mild, and usually does not cause severe diseases. So this is something actually we still do not fully understand, mm-hmm. how the virus evolved and why it actually so much compromised its disease causing ability.
Now, I think for the most of laymen, lay people, not the scientists, the biggest and most controversial enigma surrounding COVID-19 is its origin. Do you think we will ever be 100% sure how it came about?
I hope that we could be 100% sure, but I don't think it's likely because history is a good lesson. If you look back at the history, when we trace them back to the virus trying to find its origin, most of them actually only give you certain clues. You almost never will find an absolute answer. Because particularly in the case like coronavirus, this virus can infect basically all mammals. With a virus with such a broader host, then it's also almost impossible to find out its so-called origin.
I know that you personally don't believe that this virus could have escaped from the lab, as some people and some statesmen have speculated. How would you respond then to your colleagues who insist that the virus with such a complicated genetic makeup, particularly the double CGG sequence, which makes the COVID-19 pathogen so contagious, that it couldn't have evolved naturally? How would you respond to that?
Well, I don't think, you know, that statement is accurately reflecting the COVID-19 virus. Basically, is that the virus has been identified in bats and in natural animals. And if you look at the sequences, there are plenty of research, not only in China, but also in European countries as well. I think one of the best research was done by a British scientist in London, and basically he traced the bats in Yunnan and in other parts of China, and the sequence looked at the virus, this coronavirus evolution, and his conclusion is that it's more likely the virus actually from bats and transmitted into a mammal, and the mammal actually eventually evolved and transmitted into human, because this is more kind of robust scientific evidence. So to be simple, that simply because this virus has such a complex ability in infecting human beings, it actually is more likely that the virus is evolving in the mammal and becoming more adaptable in the human environment. And we do have such examples in other viruses.
Now, as we discussed before, China was among the first countries to introduce lockdowns and among the last to relax them. And I heard you say that this zero tolerance approach has been working fairly well for your country, and yet you believe that it's not sustainable much longer. Why is that?
I think we have to look at it, you know, in a different perspective of this virus transmission before year 2021 and after year 2021, because the viruses are very different. In the early days, the viruses are much more disease-causing. Has much more disease-causing ability. When people contract the virus, they develop severe diseases and even deaths. So overall, if you look at the infected population, the severe case percentages was much higher than our current virus, the Omicron. Since early this year, when the Omicron take a hold in China, so the severe cases were very few. And the death cases were also very low, but the virus transmitted so quickly. Mm-hmm. So early the zero clearance, the clearance policy was designed to deal with the virus which transmitted much slower, but causes much more severe diseases. So when the policy was implemented during the first 2 years, it was very effective. I mean, controlling the virus from spreading, from infecting large populations. So that's why overall China's health system was still capable of dealing with the infected population. But once we step into year 2022, when the Omicron was the major variant circulating in China, the virus is transmitted so fast. So all the policy, the zero clearance policy, were no longer able to contain the virus. If you look at the outbreaks, in this year, that basically it's all over China, although they are relatively small scales. But that gives us a very clear indication that you can really effectively control it.
Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm mistaken here, but from what I understand, it's not that the Chinese authorities are lifting all restrictions altogether. You know, the infected patients still have to be quarantined. They can be quarantined at home rather than in state facilities, but it is still pretty severe by some standards measures. I mean, more severe than in other countries. And with roughly, I think, 90% of the Chinese population vaccinated, why do you need such strict measures to continue? What's the goal of that? What's the purpose?
Okay. the overall complete vaccination in the Chinese population is over 90%. It's very high. But if you look at the elderly population, 65 years old, or particularly the population aged 80 and above, in this particular population, the national average vaccination rate is only 67%. So basically means that you have more than 30% of the people are not fully vaccinated, or they were not vaccinated at all. So when you add that number, it's a huge number in China. So if this population is infected, Hong Kong is a good example that this particular population without the vaccination is at a higher risk of severe diseases and even deaths. So that's, I think, one of the key reasons why the government actually is only partially open. If you are infected, you still need to be quarantined and receive a certain kind of, you know, restrictions. I think this is a sensible approach by minimizing the impact on the highly vulnerable population.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about other segments of the population, this announcement about moderating the Chinese policy came after a series of protests in China, which some of your Western partners took with quite a bit of delight. Do you think this decision to adjust the policy a little bit, was it taken purely on medical grounds, or do you think the Chinese authorities too have to be mindful of social frustration, building social frustration, because Chinese people are people too, and they have all the emotions that come with being human being? And do they have to take into account also the eagerness with which some of your neighbors or perhaps foreign actors react to social protests?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the major factor in determining this opening up probably is the medical and the economical reason. But my gut feeling is that the general population's frustration, okay, anger, also are playing some important roles. For myself, I'm so frustrated because if you go anywhere, you know, you have to show your COVID-19 code and screen things, and also present your nucleic acid test and negative results. It's just a hassle. It's okay for a couple of years, and particularly when you know that the virus is deadly, I'm fine, I don't want to die, okay? But when you see that the virus is pretty safe, okay? When you watch TV and people in other countries seem to be moving freely, and you see, you know, soccer teams, soccer games, and people do not wear, you know, a face mask. The thing is that people naturally will reflect, express their frustration, and why we need to, you know, still need to be restricted. So I think those definitely will play a part in decision making. But my gut feeling is that the key reason is the medical reason and the economical reason. If you look at the current opening policy, it's basically, you can see, that designed to minimize the disruption of people's daily life. But still, if you're infected, you need to be restrained, and there are certain policies basically, you have to obey and to minimize the impact on others.
I see. Well, Dr. Wu, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye then.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.